Good morning, everyone. It is 9:01. We're going to wait 4 more minutes. We have the 5-minute rule in compliance. We always start 5 minutes into the hour and promise to finish on time. So if you want to get coffee, water, we get started shortly. Okay, we're going to test the audio. We have our remote participants. Can you hear us? Please talk to us in the Adobe room. This is Maggie speaking. Okay, we have thumbs up. Our technical support, thank you. They can hear us. All right, it's 9:05. We are compliant with our timekeeping. Good morning, everyone. This is Maggie Surad. Contractual compliance. Thank you for joining us this morning. This is the contractual compliance program update. It is open for everyone in the ICANN community to join us and learn more about compliance activities since the last ICANN meeting. If you are a newcomer and you want to learn more in details and it's not making sense to you, please let us know. We'll be more than happy to spend time with you afterwards. Around the table, we should have a combination of contracted parties and different ICANN community members joining us. Before we get started, I would like to recognize the compliance team who's joining us remotely and in the room with me. I want to thank you very much for your passion and commitment to quality and good work at ICANN. I want to thank Alan for his leadership of our team. I also want to thank several members with us here today. We've got our KPMG partners in the audit program who have been delivering on schedule, on budget, on time, good quality work on the audit program. And we also have Iron Mountain, who we work with very much on the registrar audit space. If I forgot anybody, I hope not. I'm talking to the people who are providing the different services. Last but not least, I want to thank all of you for joining us again this morning. This is our meeting for all of us. We're going to provide a brief update to you, but then we want to open it for Q&A. So if we're going fast through a slide, let us know, raise your hand. It's an interactive session. And before we get started, I would like to Alan to address the audience. If you want to say good morning to them,
jump in.
Jump in. All right, let's jump in. Next slide, please. So, what have we done since ICANN 51? Slide 4, please. Since ICANN 51, audit activities continue. The new registry agreement audit program results have been published. It's a result of auditing 14 GTLDs. We are in the process of getting ready to publish the Contractor Compliance Annual Report. All the reports can be found at the link provided on this slide. Next, I'm going to ask Jennifer to provide an update related to the registrars and the RAA compliance efforts in that space.
Thanks, Maggie. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Scott, Manager, Contractual Compliance, and I'll be highlighting some of the updates regarding registrars and the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, or RAA. Here's a list of some of the lessons learned that we've seen with regard to the RAA. They touch on who is, abuse, domain renewal, UDRP, and transfer. But today I want to highlight some of the issues and that hot topic of the abuse reporting requirements. Next slide, please. The abuse handling reporting requirements of the RAA are laid out in Section 3.18. There are three subsections of that provision, and two of them are laid out here. The first one is 3.18.1, and that is regarding abuse reports that come from anyone worldwide, and that's contrasted with reports coming from law enforcement, which are handled under Section 3.18.2. The requirements of each section are highlighted here. The standard for 3.18.1, where the reports are coming from non-law enforcement, require registrars to take reasonable and prompt steps to investigate and respond appropriately to any reports of abuse. What that entails will be a case-by-case determination and vary depending on what the abuse report is about. And on the next slide, we'll highlight some of the reasonable steps that we've seen registrars taking in response to abuse reports. Conversely, on Section 3.18.2, regarding law enforcement reports, those have to be reviewed within 24 hours by the registrar. Registrars also have to have a dedicated abuse email and telephone contact information for receiving law enforcement reports. And this slide details how ICANN processes abuse complaints that they receive. The initial threshold for an abuse complaint is that the reporter must show ICANN that they've already contacted the registrar with their abuse report and sent it to the registrar's abuse contact. If it passes that threshold, ICANN will then send it to the registrar, and the registrar will be requested to show certain things depending on the complaint, and those could include the steps that they took to investigate and respond to the abuse report, the time it took for them to respond to the abuse report. ICANN could request any correspondence with the complainant or the registrant, and that's where the third subsection of Section 3.18 comes into play. It's 3.18.3, which requires registrars to maintain and document the receipt and response of abuse reports. ICANN can also ask registrars to identify where the link on their website is to their abuse contact information and the handling procedure, which is also a requirement, and make sure that the registrar has the abuse contact information also located in the who is. Down below, we've listed some examples of the steps that registrars have taken to investigate and respond to abuse reports. That can include contacting the registered name holder of the affected domains, asking the registered name holder for evidence regarding the abuse report, providing any hosting information to the complainant about the hosting provider that's hosting the content of the affected domain. Registrars have performed WHOIS verifications on the domain name registration information. They've allowed transfers upon request from the registrant, and they've suspended domains. These are also the reasons that ICANN will close an abuse complaint. They correspond to the sections in 3.18, the requirements that the registrars are required to demonstrate, which is reasonable prompt steps of investigating and responding appropriately, that the law enforcement report was reviewed within the 24-hour requirement, that the abuse contact information that they're required to publish is now up and accessible, that they are maintaining records that are associated with their response to the abuse report, and if they've suspended the domain, then that's also a reason to close the complaint.
If I may interrupt here, being mindful of the time and we want to have open dialogue, the next few slides talk about additional efforts that compliance worked on since ICANN 51, and it's also slides showing you some of the closure codes and some of the complaint types that many of you contacted us are interested in. So what I'd like to do now is jump to slide 15, please, and turn the floor over to Victor Oppenheimer, who's going to provide a very high-level summary on registry and RA activities. And again, very high-level, and then we will start with our Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Maggie. Victor Oppenheimer, for the record. So to Maggie's point, I'd like to provide a brief update on efforts since ICANN 51 in LA. A lot of the material here you have seen before, but basically, if you recall, in LA, we talked about the proactive monitoring that was launched back in August, September timeframe, and these are the results of that effort. 264 TLDs were inquired regarding Section 3A, the mandatory provisions that they're required to have, that the TLDs are required to have on their registry agreement. Section 3B, the technical analysis that must be conducted to identify and report on security threats. Section 3C, which requires TLDs to publish registration policies on their website. Section 3D, requiring that generic TLDs do not limit registrations. We also, about 20% of the sample were TLDs considered GAC 1 strings. And so we checked that those TLDs had the mandatory provisions as well. And then lastly, some of the TLDs, of course, it doesn't apply to all of them, but some had voluntary PICs, and we also inquired about efforts to comply with those voluntary PICs. Next. And this is what I was mentioning before. These are the lessons learned throughout 2014. The very first one at the top, the Code of Conduct Annual Certifications, it's truly the update since ICANN 51. As you know, TLDs are required to submit by January 20, actually not all TLDs, but as applicable, some TLDs are required to either submit the continued compliance with their DOT brand or meeting the requirements of the DOT brand certification that ICANN granted them, or some TLDs requested an exemption to the Code of Conduct, so also by January 20th of each calendar year, they must submit a certification to meeting, stating that they are still meeting the requirements. Next, please.
so we're going to stop at this slide. And before we open the Q&A session, what I would like to say is a true, honest, sincere thank you to everybody. Everybody, I really mean it. Having two new agreements has been an opportunity. I don't want to say issues, guys. Opportunities for growth, for learning, not just for contracted parties, for us in compliance, for the community in general. So I know we've driven the contracted parties crazy with our inquiries, and I thank you for your time and commitment to help us address and ease the concern in the community about the perception of non-compliance. I want to thank IPC law enforcement and any and everyone who has submitted any type of complaint our way. I know we don't always close it to your satisfaction. It is about expectations. And as you've heard us say throughout this week, whether it's myself or Alan, we are working to work to address some of this disconnect in these areas. And Alan, in his new role, can speak more to that. But we do commit. We all have the same goal, which is the security and stability of the Internet and ICANN. So with that, I'm going to turn it to the audience for Q&A. Please identify yourself and your association before you ask your question. Thank you.
Probably the easiest question you'll get. Jim Prendergast, the Galway Strategy Group. Where is the presentation? I just checked in the meeting and it's not posted.
We will post all the presentations in our outreach website, and we'll send it also to the... So the reason the delay in providing the presentation, I'm being very transparent, is we need the data, and it takes us a good 15 days to collect it from one system and put it up. So it will be posted by the end of ICANN meeting on the compliance outreach website, and we will send it also to the meeting team. It will be posted in there.
Maggie, Bob Wygand here with Web.com. I have a question for you, that general question about when a registrar is trying to contact a registered name holder and their email box is full. Sometimes we'll have compliance come back to us and say, give us proof of your correspondence with the registered name holder, and we'll show that we sent them the email, but their email box is full. Let me start with that question. Is that sufficient in compliance's mind for communication to have been made to the registered name holder?
Hi, Bob. I guess it depends on the situation. So for instance, in a who is an accuracy complaint, an affirmative response is required back from registered name holders to verify their email address. So in that case, a full mailbox would not be sufficient response.
I'm sorry, it's Bob again. So then if we cannot get a hold of them through telephone verification or otherwise, you would want us to suspend that name and take down the website. That's what you're saying here, correct?
Thank you, Bob. This is Maggie. As Jennifer is saying, it is on a case by case. But may I ask you, if they don't pay their bill, how do you get hold of them if their mailbox is full? So we need to be put forth the effort based on the situation, based on the contractual obligation, to work together.
Okay. Typically, what would happen if they have a credit card on file and they're on auto renew, then it would just auto renew. So that would be the answer to your question there. But so how about a second scenario? So when a complainant sends an email to the registered name holder and it bounces because the complainant's email is blacklisted with the registrant's email provider, you don't expect us to try to troubleshoot third-party blacklisting issues, do you?
No, but there are other ways. So, for instance, in the WHOIS accuracy specification, registrars can manually verify rather than getting that affirmative response as an alternative to suspending the domain. So as long as there's evidence there that your registrar has taken other steps to address, if it's a whois complaint, for example, the inaccuracy, then that would, if you provide that, we can work with you.
Thank you. I think the specific example is where compliance was saying, we want proof that you got a hold of the registered name holder. And our point was, the email address is fine. The complainant's email address is being blocked. It's being blacklisted. So I just be aware those scenarios do occur, and just you might want to have a use case for situations like that, because as far as we're concerned, we're not here to troubleshoot third-party blacklisting issues. Thank you.
So this is Maggie. There is a very creative world out there, and I think that's the opportunities for all of us to collaborate. And if faced with a scenario like this, Bob, we'll have to dialogue. I don't have the answer. I'm not technically savvy to tell you how to go about it. But we do have technical security team we can refer to. We can find a solution, and we will work with you. Just let us know. And what we ask for, as we've always said, is based on some of the lessons learned and what we see. And you guys may have a different approach to it. Just let us know what it is, and we'll let you know if it's sufficient.
One thing that might be helpful, and this is Bob again, and we talked about this in the registrar stakeholder meeting group yesterday, is for compliance to be putting together use cases like this to say, hey, here are some scenarios that do occur. Here's the burden of proof that we are looking for. And oh, by the way, in these particular situations, we would consider A, B, C, and D to be fine or sufficient. So we have new people who are hired into our compliance group who may not be as familiar with the metrics that you're looking for in compliance, and vice versa. You have new employees as well. And I think sometimes when the correspondence is going back and forth, it might be because there are some new people on the staffs. And that would just be a recommendation that was, again, made yesterday that I think would be beneficial to both parties. Thank you.
So the recommendation was started on Sunday night when we met with the XCOM team. And the initial deck I submitted to the registrar the registrar stakeholder, Paul. I don't know Paul's role. I'm sorry.
That's better. Thank you. Michaela Nayland for the transcript, chair of the registrars. Paul Goldston is the registrar stakeholder group secretary. So Maggie and anybody else who was addressing the registrar stakeholder group yesterday would have sent their slide decks to him, and he would have then distributed them either within the stakeholder group and elsewhere. Thanks.
So what I wanted to say here to everybody in the audience, based on the concerns we heard Sunday night, but also through other meetings early in the week, we went and added those two slides. If you do a comparison to what was provided and now what we updated, we added slide 8 and slide 9 to provide clarity of what is ICANN requesting, may request. So, for example, those bullets under what ICANN could request is a guideline that guides our staff. And it's a guideline also to let the community know how and what we work with and what are some of the examples that registrars respond to and what are some examples that compliance may close a complaint without putting the specifics out there. So this is an attempt we try to put with upcoming policy updates that are happening, but also in any presentation we add the guidelines. We call them guidelines, not good practices or best practices, because we do recognize the fact that everybody has different operation. We don't want to impose a way. We provide guideline, what we're looking for. But please let us know if those guidelines, there's another one we need to add. We'll be happy to review it and add it.
And this is Alan Grogan, just for the record. I mean, there are a lot of places in the agreement that use terms like reasonable and appropriate action, and we recognize that what is reasonable and appropriate will depend on the circumstances. Bob or anybody else has specific use cases or examples or questions that they want to kick around with us, it would be very helpful for us if you would submit some of those to us so we can talk about those in concrete terms, because one of the difficulties we've encountered sometimes is we get very broad complaints that compliance is being unreasonable and is interpreting the contract differently than the contracted parties. And an abstract proposition like that is very hard to respond to. Some of the examples that you gave, we could sit down and have a dialogue about what might be reasonable and appropriate under those circumstances. So.
Thanks, Alan. Bob Wygand again for the record. I think that one thing that would also be helpful is sometimes we'll get a response from compliance that says, your response was incomplete. We would like that to be followed with because. Your response was incomplete because. And then I would like the reason the complaint was incomplete to be included in the response. So that's just, and I'm literally right now just going through some tickets, and we're replying to your team saying, why was our initial response incomplete, and why is it now at a second notice? So there's just, again, we want to be collaborative, but there's just kind of this back and forth that's occurring, as I mentioned yesterday to the board. I think it creates some tension between the organizations that I don't think need to be there. Thank you.
Hi, this is Jonathan Denson from Contractual Compliance. There's a couple questions there in the queue. So Alan Woods from Right Side has a question. Could you confirm regarding complaints, does ICANN Compliance undergo any merits review of complaints prior to issuing compliance notices to the relevant party?
If you could go to slide 10, please. Hi, Alan. Thanks for your question. We do have a slide here in the deck to address this question. ICANN always validates reporters' complaints before sending them on to registrars. We sometimes ask the registrar to provide information, certain information, depending on what type of complaint it is, before sending it on to the registrar. If you look at our metrics slides, you'll see that invalid complaints are also included there, and there's a large portion of complaints that are received by ICANN that are never forwarded to the registrar. And slide 10 here details quality efforts that ICANN also undertakes after complaints have been sent to registrars. These efforts ensure consistency across staff, as well as to make sure that registrars are continuing to do what they need to do after a complaint has been closed or a non-compliance issue has been remediated. Go ahead.
Sorry, Yasmin Omer from ARI Registry Services. I just wanted to clarify your response to Alan's question, because you mentioned that registrar complaints are validated. Are registry complaints also validated?
Yes. Yes. Sorry about that. All complaints are looked at by staff before going to any contracted party.
Maxim Zobov, IT for the record. Was it this measure of checking the compliant and when did you start to apply it? Because we had a case where in the text of the case it was visible that basically the case itself wasn't treated properly by the agent who was in charge of interaction with us, for example. So compliant that demanded something which was not in line with the text of the complaint itself, and it wasn't checked, for example.
Without looking at the specific case you're referring to, I'm not sure how to answer that, other than if you see something that's out of line with the original report that's appended to the notice sent to your contracted party, just write back and let us know what it is, why it might be inconsistent. Sometimes ICANN does receive information that's anonymized from reporters depending on the type of complaint that we don't always forward to the contracted party.
And if the subject was questionable, does it stop timer of those 1, 2, 3 notices?
Yes. If there's more time needed to respond, just let us know that. Give us, you know, a basis for an extension request, and we'll work with you to stop that clock.
Thank you. Steve Metallitz with the Coalition for Online Accountability. First, I want to thank Maggie and Alan and the rest of the team for your presentation at the IPC yesterday and the discussion we had there. I think it was very useful, and we appreciate your commitment to try to bring some more clarity to this 318.1 area and the equivalent. And I would just say to the registrars here that if you find the process opaque, from the complainant standpoint, it's far more opaque because we don't see half of what you're seeing. So hopefully we'll be able to get some more transparency there. I did want to ask a question about, I think it's slide 8, where you listed the examples of what registrars had done in response to a complaint. Yes, thank you. So the bottom list there. I'm trying to understand what the significance of this list is. Is this purely descriptive? You're saying these are things that were done? Or are you suggesting that these are things that, depending on the case, would constitute reasonable investigation and appropriate response in terms of the contract?
This here is just a list of examples of things that we've seen as steps taken. In our notices, ICANN doesn't tell registrars and registries what to do to resolve an issue or a noncompliance. So these are examples. You know, like Maggie said before, get creative, show us what your business model handles in response to these types of reports.
So these are things that the registrars have told you, but you're not, this is not a statement that in any particular case this is sufficient. Is that, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's why I understand what you just said.
Yeah, it's a case-by-case determination, so it really depends on what the abuse report is about, the potential harm from the alleged abuse. You know, you're probably going to handle a child pornography report differently than a spam report.
Yeah, understood. And the next to last one, I wasn't clear on what, if you could shed a little more light on that. So you forward a complaint to the registrar. The registrar tells you, we transferred the domain on the request of the registrant. Well, I guess McKaylee's going to give me the answer to that question.
No, thanks, Steve. It's McKaylee for the record. I can understand why that's confusing you, because believe me, if you saw some of the really odd abuse complaints we get, you'd be confused too. We have had abuse complaints that have actually ended up with compliance because instead of logging into the control panel we provide to update their contact details or to open a support ticket, they sent an abuse complaint to compliance. So I think that is probably in there because somebody was trying to transfer a domain name, and instead of getting the EPP code and unlocking the domain with their registrar, they went straight to compliance to complain or something like that. So I think it's maybe putting it there on that slide might be causing confusion, but it's probably an example of, you know, somebody who's using ICANN as a customer support service instead of anything else. I mean, this is part of the frustration we're having in general with just people sending things to really odd places. I mean, I'll give you another example. We published on our website about 3 weeks ago an email address so that any new domain registries could contact us using that email address. I had to take the damn thing down because in the space of 48 hours, we received, it's like 15 queries that had nothing to do with domain registries. And we're a tiny registrar in the grand scheme of things.
I'll give you another example, Steve. We complain sometimes about domain name hijacking, and our ability to address that directly is limited, but sometimes we'll reach out to the registrar. The registrar will contact the the registrar to which the name was transferred after the hijacking, they'll work out a deal to transfer it back. So you could have a circumstance like that where there's a transfer back in order to undo a hijacking.
Thank you. That clarifies this. But so this list, I mean, it's interesting, but what we're hoping to see, and I think it's what the gentleman across the way was asking for, some more specific concrete use cases. We don't bring that, those types of complaints, obviously, and so we want to have a clear understanding of what we need to show in order to get action, you know, from compliance, and then what will constitute in those cases sufficient, reasonable response. So we will pursue that with you as you've invited us to do, and again this morning as you've invited. So hopefully we'll get more clarity on that. Thank you.
Bob Wygand again for the record. So Maggie had mentioned yesterday that they were also thinking about implementing more use codes so that when they respond, maybe when you would respond to the complainant, you would say this issue was closed, see use code 4. And that would mean, you know, the name was suspended or something like that.
So this is Maggie. An example might be, if you can go to slide 12. When we close, when ICANN receives complaints, it goes through the process. As we shared on slide 8, but we don't need to go there, every complaint that comes into ICANN goes through some kind of validation. Some validations are automated. Regardless, after that check is done, we do an eye check to make sure there are other things that cannot be automated. And it goes through the process. From the beginning until closure of a complaint, it's tracked. And if and when it's closed, a closure reason is assigned to it. When we started 3.5 years ago, we had 20 closure codes. Now we're up in the hundreds. So what we are working towards is by the next ICANN meeting to be able to bring forward some of the reporting and the closure reasons on abuse and bring more clarity, as we've heard from this meeting, to be prepared to have some of those cases discussed and the reasons shared with everybody and the percentage of those.
Maxim Azobov, IT for the record. Could you please go to the slide 16? And, section 3B, conducting security threats technical analysis at the time of inquiry. Could you please share your findings? Because were these data bits analyzed somehow, or just was it just collection of data about the Spec 11 things related to security? What did you do with this bits of data from different registries? Thanks.
Victor Oppenheimer for the record. As stated before, for Section 3B, we inquired TLDs per their obligations on the contract in terms of are you conducting security, the technical analysis, have you started? And a few of them had not, but through the informal resolution process committed to remediate the situation and start the technical analysis. And also we required reports. As you know, that section also allows ICANN to request the reports on the security threats identified and any actions taken on them. So essentially that's the data collection that was made under that effort.
The question was, what did you do with these bits of data? Were you analyzing it? Because without the analysis of the collected data, it just, I don't know, the compliance is checking our deeds or our texts versus the contract and other documents which are obligatory for us. And without the checking of the subject, it just, we don't understand what was it done for.
Sure, I understand your question now, sorry. Victor Oppenheimer for the record. Of all the reports received, I can review whether any security threat was identified as and not an action taken, but all of the reports that were submitted to us either had no security threat identified, or if a security threat was identified, an action was reported, and so therefore I can consider that no further action was needed.
If I may add, this is Maggie. Maxim, this was addressed in a similar fashion when we are asking for facts to support reviewing an obligation. To Victor's point, reports were submitted, and Section Specification 11, Section 3B, provides a high-level guidance on what is expected in the report without detailing it. And as you can imagine, based on the operations and readiness of the different GTLD operators, the level of information provided can be, at a minimum, what's in 3B, and some have even more. The team would review it, and if there are additional questions, we would have followed up. But at this point, it's more of a validation. Is it there? Is it at a minimum being addressed? And as Victor mentioned, the initial reviews were not alarming, so there was no need for a follow-up.
And this is Alan Grogan. Most of you probably know this, but there is an effort underway to develop a framework to flesh out what appropriate actions might be under that section, not to make those binding contractual commitments, but to establish, if you will, kind of a safe harbor or a recommendation of practices for what periodic scanning for security threats would might be appropriate. I think there are a lot of registries that are already doing that. There are some of the smaller registries that either may not be or may be confused about what it is that would be expected of them, and the framework in part is to try to at least provide some guidance on what people could do without dictating what they have to do.
Thanks. Yasmin Omer, ARI Registry Services. So clearly compliance or proactively monitoring compliance with Specification 11. What other obligations in the registry agreement are you proactively monitoring?
Victor Oppenheimer for the record. So at a very high level, there is a distinct difference between the registrar world and the registry world, in the sense that the registrar world is essentially driven by external complaints, because obviously the registrars are the face of, with the registrants, with transactional work. That obviously is not the case with the registries. ICANN has built for the new G program monitoring tools, our compliance receives exception reports. Those exception reports are evaluated before sending notices to the registries. So in the sense, that is also proactive monitoring. The access to the weekly access to thin data, the SLA monitoring, that's all not driven by external reports, but rather by our own systems. And in that sense, it's also proactive. So a lot of the technical, if you will, technical requirements on the RA are proactively monitored as well.
And this is Alan. I mean, depending on how you define proactive, we also look at reports in the media of abuse. We read columns and newspapers and so forth, and if we notice that there is a pattern of complaints about registry activities, we may proactively reach out to inquire about those. We don't necessarily wait for a formal complaint to come into compliance before we initiate investigations.
Thanks. So it's not just limited to Spec 11, is what you're saying? Yep.
Correct. Yeah, that's generally.
Thanks.
Okay, we have another question from Rob Golding. The question is, what options exist for registrants, registrars, and registries to challenge bogus claims by ICANN compliance, which are ICANN staff are unilaterally deciding to mission creep into regulating content which is outside of ICANN remit and contacts?
So I don't know that there's a formal structured appeals process, but you can reach out to us, and if you get a notice and you believe that the complaint is outside the scope of what is required or outside the scope of ICANN's remit, respond that way. If you ask for an extension of time and you want to have a dialogue with ICANN compliance or ICANN legal to discuss it, we'd consider granting an extension to your time to respond while we do that, as long as that's not used abusively, right? So if you want a week to schedule a phone call to talk about that, we'd entertain doing that. If you want 18 months to schedule a phone call, we probably wouldn't.
I know we have a room full in the back. Any questions? Okay, we have somebody.
This is Reg Levy from Minds Machines. And earlier it was discussed that ICANN reviews all of the requests that come in, all of the complaint notices. But there's a difference between reviewing and validating. And when you first said ICANN validates all of them, and then at the very end you actually said, we look at them all, which is completely different. So I know that I have received notices from compliance asking for information about why I did X, when in fact X had not happened, and that was just the allegation. We've spoken earlier about the fact that compliance feels adversarial, and so I'm just wondering if there's a different way of framing that. So instead of when did you stop beating your wife, maybe start out asking me if I'm married in the first place, because a lot of times the requests that I've received are so off base that I don't know how to, not a lot of times, but occasionally, I will get requests from compliance that are so off base that I just don't even know how to respond. I'm like, I can't prove to you that I didn't do this, because it's just not, I can't. There's
So, thank you for the question. This is Maggie. I'd like to take the first part, and Victor, if you don't mind addressing the second part. You are correct. I did say validate, and I said we look at it, because it is on a case-by-case and on obligations. Most of the validations relate to some, for example, for who is inaccuracy. By running the validation, is the domain name still exist? Is it suspended? That's what I meant. And I did unspecifically say look at it. Because, again, when we say look at it, means we do an eye check. Do we have the information correct? Is this? Because some stuff you cannot automate, but it's not necessarily that we can validate at that level. With that, I would like to turn it to Victor maybe to address some of the monitoring stuff that went your way probably and with question.
Yeah, Victor Oppenheimer for the record. So, Rich, Yeah, go ahead.
So actually, this was not in relation to a monitoring system. This was actually in relation to a complaint that it was the same issue involved, where there was a complaint, and then the compliance request was, why didn't you do X? And the response was, well, we didn't not do X because we didn't, and so where is this coming from? Instead of, potentially it could have been framed as, there was an allegation that X happened, what's your evidence?
What I was going to, Victor Oppenheimer again. Perhaps, Rich, it would help us if you can send a specific case, because in the abstract I really cannot help you, but you're obviously we agree with the general principles that you're stating.
Hi, Reg. Jennifer Scott, for the record. I think I know which specific example you're talking about, and we can talk about that offline more. But like Victor said, we've taken that comment back from your response to the ticket, and we're discussing that. So thank you.
And I have no idea what the specific matter is that you're referring to, but I agree with you kind of as a matter of principle that, yeah, there is a difference between saying, why did you do X, and it is alleged that you did X. Is that true? And if so, why? Right?
Yeah, and that's much more where I'm going. I mean, the specific case, which all of you can just wonder about, is resolved. I mean, it's totally off my radar at this point. But the tone is helpful, and it encourages collaboration when it's, we've received this report. What's your side? As opposed to just like...
So this is Maggie, and that's why we have inquiries versus notices. And I have received feedback about the tone in the registry space. So we are revisiting the communication templates, especially in the informal resolution phase. The tone is really about informal resolution, and we will work on addressing that. Thank you for bringing it to our attention.
I will say, and this will be my last comment, that if what I'm complaining about is the tone, then we're probably in a good place. So... thank you, guys.
Hello. I think... Jordan Buchanan with Google. I think that at previous compliance discussions, I've asked for consideration of a new metric to track cases raised in error by ICANN as a metric, with the goal of eventually managing that towards zero. I think in my last discussion when I raised this, Alan had indicated that that might be that or something like it might be an interesting metric. So I was wondering if any progress has been made into some sort of consideration of some sort of erroneous complaints due to either like a system failure or misinterpretation by ICANN. So that's my first question. I have a follow-up depending on the answer.
So the short answer, I think, unless somebody corrects me, is no, we don't have that in place. I do remember the discussion. I do agree it's an interesting idea, and I will make a note of that.
Okay, I guess then my follow-up question is, I think you guys do have a category for closing, which is closed, no action by, basically it was closed and the registry or the registrar didn't have to do anything in order to resolve it, right?
Victor Oppenheimer, yes, registry demonstrated compliant. That's essentially the closure code that tells us that an allegation was sent your way and the TLD demonstrated with evidence that there was no basis on the...
Right, yeah, so many of those could be raised not due to an error by ICANN, but just because... it was not observable to you one way or the other as to whether there was compliance at the time you raised. Yeah, so it's not quite the same thing. But do you guys track, how does that trend over time? I would also expect that you would want that to trend down generally over time.
Are you referring to the closure code trending?
Yeah, that's right. I'm wondering over the last sort of 3, 6, 12 months how that particular closure code has been trending.
We have not. I have not looked at the trend. I oversee the metrics. And if you don't mind, Jordan, can you send me an email about the specific metric you are referring to earlier in your first set of questions, in the first question? What is the metric about? Define it and tell me what is the expectation. Let me review it, and if we have follow-up questions, I'll follow up with you. But I would also like to put it to the rest of the contracted parties because I don't want to just take Jordan's perspective. I want to make sure when we are putting a metric together, it fits the stakeholder group that it's representing. So define it, send me what would be the measure of it, and what is the expectation, please, in an email, and we will get back to you on that one.
So a couple questions. First one, going back to Rob Golding's original question, is there a formal appeals process beyond sending it to the ombudsman. This is the interpretations.
This is Alan Grogan. I was hesitating for a moment because I want to make sure I give you an accurate answer. Let me think about that in the context of ICANN accountability mechanisms and get back to you with an answer. I don't want to answer that on the fly and get that wrong.
Question from Chris Pelling. It's a bit long. It says, I need clarification, please, on the 2013 RAA section 5.5.2.4, which says if a registrar A has a UDRP filing set against them, they are named, with regards to a bad faith registration against another registrar B, where the actual name registered is protected under a European trademark, can 5.5.2.4 be invoked by ICANN at the request of registrar B? 5.5.2.4 also states through its affiliate in a pattern and practice of trafficking in or use of domain names identical or confusingly similar to a trademark. If multiple examples, at what point does ICANN take action?
This is, thank you for the question. And I have had three coffees this morning, but what we're going to do, we will take it from the Adobe room, review it, and if you can please send us your email. Actually, here's what we'll do. Please email it to us, yes. Email it to us, and we will respond to it. Thank you. We also have, for the registrars, you know, we have the closed session tomorrow to talk about interpretations and discussions of scenarios. So hopefully by tomorrow we can have that response.
Steve Metalitz from the IPC. I think this follows on to Jordan's comment that you know, if you're going to have a closure code that said, because ICANN, you know, screwed up, you need to have somebody else making that determination, I think. And it raises this issue of appeal. And, you know, just from the complainant standpoint, when you file a very extensive evidence case about abuse that's taking place in a domain name that's sponsored by a particular registrar, and the response from ICANN is, ICANN has reviewed and closed your complaint because the registrar demonstrated that it took reasonable and prompt steps to investigate and respond appropriately to the report of abuse, period. ICANN considers this matter now closed. Please do not reply to this email. Replies to closed complaints are not monitored by ICANN staff. Well, I mean, I don't think it's just a question of tone. I think basically you're saying go take a flying leap and there's no appeal. So I would encourage you to look at both how this is phrased, because it tells you nothing. It just recites the language of the complaint, of the contract. And it says, they were in compliance, so go away. We don't think they were in compliance. So we need more information, in other words, to understand why the complaint was dismissed and in default. And, you know, either that can be through a process that involves the ICANN compliance team, or else it involves getting a fresh pair of eyes to look at it. So one way or the other, I hope we can improve on that.
So if I may address the first part, and I know someone from the audience wants to address the second part. Regarding closure complaints, the tool, we cannot receive it when it's closed. However, I think everybody knows, and I'll take it as an action item, not sure what the level of effort is to update the templates across all, where we can say, if you still have questions, send an email to compliance@ICANN.org. So I can address only that part, and I think somebody will. Michele, you wanted to address the second part.
Sure. Michele, chair of the registrars, who I think Mr. Metalitz has had issues with about some of these apparent compliance complaints. I mean, the issue around the response you're getting back from ICANN compliance, and you know, I think Maggie and her team can address that, because that's more of a software issue than anything else. from the registrar's perspective, there is a, you know, we have a contract to which we are expected to comply. You know, we have to, we go backwards and forwards with ICANN compliance. Maybe you feel that you're not getting as much of an answer as you might like, but, you know, it's a matter between us and them. We are not, we do not have a contract with you. I mean, I don't really understand what it is that you're actually looking for.
Michelle, if you don't understand what I'm looking for, and if you don't know how to pronounce my name after 10 years, I'm a little concerned about that, too. If you think this is just between you and the and ICANN, I don't think you understand the multi-stakeholder model, and I question whether you understand why we're participating in this organization.
We're talking here about, this is Michaela again for the record, we're talking about here about contractual compliance, which has got nothing to do with multi-stakeholder models or anything else. This is a matter of a contract between two parties. Now, if you feel that, I don't know, that there's something that should be in a contract or there's something that should be in a policy, that's something which you can raise within the multi-stakeholder model. However, the contract is the contract as written. Now, there are issues around interpretation. There are issues in interpretation from people who are sending in reports who are expecting registrars to take action for things which do not fall within the remit of the contract. There may be other avenues to raise those issues, but potentially not through that avenue.
Well, Michaela, you made a big assumption there that the complaint was not within the scope of the contract. You don't know whether it was or not. I'm saying that when we put in a complaint, we'd like to know why it was rejected and not just say the registrar was in compliance.
I love ICANN. I love the passion we all have. Thank you very much. I understand the frustration. We're on the receiving end from everybody on that frustration. I think we made it clear at the beginning of this week and ever since abuse reporting was added in the contract. There is an opportunity for additional clarification. There is an opportunity to have further dialogues. And I don't want to say ICANN screwed up. ICANN is all of us. So let's make it proactive. Katie from the IPC sent me some of those emails. I'm very familiar. When I saw it, I do not remember the details. Before we leave this meeting, we are going to regroup and let you know. I, as leader of the compliance department, and I know Alan as leader of our department too, take it to heart and listen to everybody. And my role, like I said, by the next ICANN meeting, if not before, we bring more visibility to abuse reporting, to closure codes. Jordan's going to send me some additional stuff, and if it's not time, you know, we'll have to look at the assessment, how long it takes and by when can we execute that, because we do have a list of things we're working towards. We can't just put that on the top. But thank you very much for your feedback. Really, I hear the frustration. We're frustrated too, so let's get this addressed and we'll go from there.
And just briefly, partly in response to the question that was posed in the Adobe chat room and partly in response to this discussion. So while there is not a formal appeals process within the compliance department, as I said, you can reach out to us and we'll engage with you, hopefully constructively. Beyond that, there are ICANN accountability mechanisms, and again, this is one of those questions that's difficult to answer in the abstract, but the ICANN accountability mechanisms, you know, high level are reconsideration, independent review, ombudsman, so depending on what it is your complaint is, it's conceivable it might fit within one of those, and you could consider that and look at our webpage on accountability mechanisms to determine that.
That's okay. I'll send my question and I'll submit it. It was more tactical in nature.
Maxima Zoba, is it possible to have those closure codes? It will let us understand your logic more, like deeply, so we could address questions to you more like accurately. Is it possible?
That's what I said earlier, Maxime. We are going to see to pull those closure codes and report on them like we've done before. Yes.
It's Jordan Buchanan with Google again. So 2 points on closure codes and metrics more generally. One is on closure codes. I think Steve made a great point that it's helpful to, like, you, I think you guys are self-identifying closure codes at the moment, which is fine, but I think some ability just to create some transparency into that would be useful. So maybe at the time the case is closed to make it so the registry or the registrar sees the closure code as well, so just so if we disagree we could engage you on that. That might be helpful. And then second, Maggie, you said earlier that you don't track the trends on closure codes, it sounds like. What are the metrics that you do track trends on over time, and how do you determine which one, you know, whether to add or remove things from that mix?
So the data is available. If I want to look at the trends, it's available. I'm saying I have not personally spent time looking at it. Again, there's so many high priority issues we've been working with, and if trending on those abuse complaints or closure codes are important, let us know. On our performance measurement and reporting page, we do publish a lot of information, and that's an ongoing progress. So if there is a data that is valid and we hear requests from stakeholder groups, not individuals, please, we cannot just cater to individual needs. If there's a request that's coming, bring it with a voice from a stakeholder group for the sake of transparency. We will take that request, get with you to understand it, and then evaluate the level of effort and get back to you on when and how it will be executed.
Michaeli, for the record. No, just on this entire thing around dealing with, you know, improvements and clarifications and all that kind of thing. From the Registrar Stakeholder Group XCOM, as well as the Registry Stakeholder Group XCOM, have a kind of a standing meeting with ICANN's GDD staff on the Sunday night of the ICANN meetings. It doesn't appear on the public schedules, but we do have it. And of course, yes, we do have a super secret meeting and discuss how we're going to overthrow the empire. But no, seriously, one of the topics that has come up in those meetings, and also in other meetings we've had with Maggie, Alan, and others on their team, is around, you know, some of these issues that are pain points both for registrars and registries. I mean, if the reporters are having issues, so are the registrars and registries. And you know, it's a matter, I suppose, of just seeing exactly what the issues are, being as specific as we can be, and then working to improve the entire experience for everybody. I mean, to Steve's point around the closures. And sometimes on the registrar side, for example, you just get back a notice saying, ticket closed. And, of course, there's no explanation as to why the ticket's been closed apart from it's closed. In my case, I'm usually just happy the damn thing's closed. In other people's cases, they may have spent a huge amount of time, money, energy and effort resolving it and are wondering, you know, what was the magic sauce that they used to do so. And they go, this is something that is being addressed and hopefully will be addressed further in the coming months. Thanks.
So we have 5 minutes left on the agenda.
Maggie?
Yes.
With 5 minutes left, I'll ask my question. This is Jennifer Standiford for the transcript. And related to slide number 16, the examples of the steps the registrars took to investigate and respond to abuse reports, specifically referring to bullet point number 2, asking for and obtaining evidence or licenses. Can you elaborate on that?
Jennifer, which slide deck are you looking
slide
at?
Slide 16.
Okay.
Bullet point number 2 in the bottom grouping, asking for and obtaining evidence or licenses. I want to hear that from
you. Yes, Jennifer Scott for the record. So this is a list of examples that we've seen of steps taken by registrars in response to abuse reports. Licenses there refers to usually pharmacy licenses. We've had some complaints in the abuse space regarding online pharmacies. And once a registrar has contacted a registrant, the registrant might reply and say X, Y, and Z, and then a registrar might go back to the registrant and say, can you provide supporting documentation for X, Y, and Z? And when that relates to a pharmacy complaint, sometimes that's a pharmacy license. It might be some other type of license as well. That was just one example of documentation that we have seen, though.
And under the PICs in Spec 11, although we don't have a lot of experience with those yet, for some of the highly regulated strings, one of the requirements is that the registrar obtain a representation from the registrant that it has any necessary credentials. So it's possible that, for example, if you had a dot doctor registrant who represented that he or she had the necessary credentials for registration of a domain name, and somebody made a complaint that they didn't, that the registrar might reach out to the registrant, ask them if they actually have the credentials that they represented and warranted that they did have, and then submit that as proof that, in fact, they not only got that representation from the registrant, but that the registrant really is a doctor.
Have two more minutes left.
Jim Prendergast, Galway Strategy Group. Alan, just following up on that, I mean, what it is right now, the requirement on the registrant is to tick a box saying that you have this. And in the case that you just raised, so give me the credentials that prove that you're a doctor. What if the registrant doesn't provide those? I mean, are you supposed to suspend the name because they didn't provide that? Or it seems like you're putting the registrar into a verification area that they're not technically or professionally able to deal with.
So, again, I think we're going to have to deal with those on a case-by-case basis as complaints come in and determine what appropriate action is by the registrar. It's hard to answer that in the abstract.
Just to Jim's point, Michele, for the record, I kind of understand your question, but I would have thought that some of that would depend on the registry's contract, surely. So, I mean, some of the registries that have certain restrictions are asking the registrar to collect certain information, whereas other ones, you're not actually asked to prove anything until they do some kind of check or audit on the registrant further down the line. I mean, I'm just trying to understand what you're doing. But, of course, the other thing as well is, I love to raise this one, is if you were to register doctor.eu, you wouldn't have to provide anything. So I just find it rather amusing that just because it's got magical pixie dust on the right of the dot, that you're expected to provide extra documentation. But, you know, that's just me.
Right. No, I guess the point, you're right. It depends on the RRA and the registration policies as to what the registrar actually has to collect, but if it is a simple tick the box, just say you have the credentials, you know, then what's the obligation on the registrar to actually get that if all you have to do is tick the box?
But, Michele, again, I mean, I think, isn't this in the contract? And Maggie's upset because we're eating into her coffee break. I think it depends on the contract, to be perfectly honest with you. So I've looked at the contracts we've got from several registries that have restrictions, and some of them have an entire kind of validation verification type thing. Others, it's a self-declaration or affirmation or whatever the terminology is, because I haven't had the coffee yet. So I think it depends on the contract. Asking them to answer that is probably a little bit unfair on them.
So, if you guys are familiar with the soap opera concept in the U.S., join us Thursday for continuation in Days of Our Lives of the Contracted Parties. But thank you very much for everyone's participation. I just want to do one more comment. I heard from the contracted parties on the closure code, because it involves system and upgrades and all the stuff to go and add why we closed a complaint. I'm addressing the contracted parties only. A complaint is sent your way with specific, specifically identifying where there's an alleged non-compliance to a provision, or specifically asking for information. So when ICANN sends a closure notice to the contracted party, says this complaint is closed, thank you. Again, future recommendation for continuous improvement, we can list why, but for the time being, until it's updated, it's in reference to information being provided and that you have met the obligation of that.
Sorry, Maggie, I really have to take issue with that.
Okay.
Because we have had issues where we have submitted information, we have had zero recognition of the fact that we have responded, we've had nothing until I poked one of your staff directly,
yes,
and then magically I get a notification to say the ticket's been closed.
Okay.
So nothing had changed about the data submitted, nothing had moved forward, and as has been discussed ad nauseum, you know, we don't have visibility on the status of
right.
the tickets, so
okay.
I think the thing is that it's not, I understand what you're saying, but at present you've got certain issues, which let's blame your IT department rather than you personally. But,
no.
You know, it's not, we're not getting responses to tickets.
Correct.
So
we're
then we end up in the situation
yes.
where the ticket's open.
Yes.
You've submitted things and you're kind of going,
yes.
okay, why are they still sitting on this?
Yes.
And then eventually get, oh, ticket closed.
Right.
It's like, why?
If I may, this is in case you didn't get a closure. For those who are getting closure notices and it says ticket is closed, it's in reference to that. We are aware we have opportunities for system improvements and working on that. With this, I'm already 5 minutes over. Thank you very much for your participation today. This has been productive, and we have a great day and rest of ICANN meeting.